This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello, people. This is Ben. This is A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Episode 164, if that's of any interest to you. And what will be of interest to you is that my guest this week is the fantastic British documentary photographer Paul Rees. And I will introduce Paul properly in a minute, as is customary. First of all, I'm excited to say I've got another new sponsor to bring you. So we'll do that in a minute. If you want to get even more exclusive, special bonus subscriber-only content of this podcast, which will be every other week on the weeks that this episode doesn't go out, you can sign up as a member at pod.fan. It's £5 a month, and you get exclusive special content, like I say, bonus questions from each week's guest, check-ins with previous guests, all kinds of good stuff. Pod.fan. You can sign up as a member, you can support the podcast, and you can get special extra useful and valuable information and insights. I'm making this up as I go along, as you can probably tell. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I could probably go back to writing scripts for this intro, but I don't know, just this week in particular. It's half term, by the way, so if I sound tired, that's why. It's only Tuesday and oh my gosh, it's getting to me already, but I digress. I'm still excited to welcome Paul Rees as my guest. Yeah, sign up as a member at pod.fan. If you want a really brilliant brand new website and you can't be bothered to figure out how to build one yourself, I will do it for you at an extremely competitive price with the Squarespace platform. Leave me a good review for this podcast at iTunes if you like it and enjoy it and you want other people to know about it. That would be great. What else? Oh, I'm going to introduce my new sponsor. So this episode of A Small Voice podcast is supported by Flow Photographic, a small but internationally renowned fine art photographic print studio in central London, specialising in printmaking, scanning, retouching and preparing photography for photo books. Flow has a global clientele comprised of galleries, photographers, artists and enthusiasts, all of whom are encouraged to drink coffee and fully discuss their requirements, working hand in hand with Flow founder and hugely experienced master printer Alex Schneiderman. This intimate communication between photographer and printmaker allows ideas about the work to fully develop. The unique combination of this super personal bespoke approach and state-of-the-art technology means that Alex can personally realise the full potential of every print. Recent clients include leading photographers such as Paddy Summerfield, Werner Bischoff, Chris Anderson, Matthew Finn and Sunil Gupta, as well as Magnum Photos, Stanley Barker Publishing and Galleries, museums and arts institutions all over the world. The lab is also home to Flow Photographic Gallery, a non-profit space that supports and showcases British documentary photography. A new exhibition, The Jungle by Isabella, I knew this was going to happen, Gendrichik. I'm going to go for that as the pronunciation. Isabella Gendrichik, Examining the People and Fashion from 1980s Tyneside, is currently showing. So you can go and see some great prints on the walls if you ever want to go down there and have a chat with Alex about your requirements. You, the Small Voice listener, can also, provided you're a new customer, currently get 20% off your first order by emailing info@flowphotographic.com with the answer to this question: who said sharpness is a bourgeois concept? So email info@flowphotographic.com with the answer to get 20% off your first order. And the website, of course, flowphotographic.com. Also, of course, this episode of A Small Voice is sponsored by the Charcoal Book Club, the monthly subscription service for photo book enthusiasts that brings essential limited edition and hard-to-find photo books to your doorstep. Working with the most respected names in contemporary photography, Charcoal Book Club selects and delivers essential photo books to a worldwide... I said photo box again. I don't know why I keep doing that. Photo books to a worldwide community of collectors, whether they be long-time enthusiasts with a stock library or novices just beginning to build their collection. Join up as a member at charcoalbookclub.com and each month you'll receive a new museum quality first edition monograph to add to your shelves, handpicked by Charcoal's team of expert curators and signed by the artist, along with a signed note card and an exclusive print. Sometimes the book of the month will be a classic title every bibliophile should own. Sometimes it will be a new release from an emerging artist who's poised to make big waves. They offer free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members also get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles, members only pricing in Charcoal's online bookstore and more, all of which makes the Charcoal Book Club the best, easiest and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. Okie doke, so my guest this week, Paul Rees, is a British social documentary photographer and educator, born in Bradford in the north of England in 1955. Until his recent retirement, Paul was the course leader of the documentary photography course established by Magnum photographer David Hearn at the University of South Wales in Cardiff, UK. He has worked commercially and editorially for many years and publishes and exhibits work internationally. Paul is perhaps best known for photographing consumerism and various aspects of daily working class life in Britain, especially during the 1980s and 1990s, and is a member of a group of hugely influential photographers commonly referred to as the second wave of British colour documentarists. Paul has produced the books I Can Help in 1988, Flogging a Dead Horse, Heritage Culture and Its Role in Post-Industrial Britain, 1993, and Fables of Phalbus in 2018. He's had solo exhibitions at the Photographers' Gallery and London College of Communication, Corner House, Manchester, and Impressions Gallery in Bradford, and his work is held in the collection of the British Council, and he is represented by the James Hyman Gallery in London. So, it was great to finally get Paul on. He's been on the list a long time, and now I'm pleased to say his voice has been added. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did.
I don't know how real you want this to be, Ben, but I'm on my own in the house, and I've got a puppy in the next room that does have a tendency sometimes to bark at passers-by.
Okay.
But I've closed the door, you know, and I've done what I can to mitigate that.
Absolutely fine. Puppies are always welcomed. Any kind of animal interruption is perfectly acceptable. When you said, I don't know how real you want this to be, I was getting excited. I was thinking you were about to be very sort of, you know, revelatory and candid about something. I was like, oh, great. You're just talking about the puppy. Yeah. Thank you for joining me. It's great to have you on finally. You're sort of an important person for me to add, I feel. How are you doing? You have very recently retired from running the documentary photography course at what used to be known as Newport in Wales. And people from this neck of the woods will probably be familiar with it. It was kind of a legendary course, which was started by David Hearn of Magnum fame. And I'm quite a number of my previous guests were alumni of that course, I'm pretty sure, and indeed people who've taught on it over the years. It moved to, was the University of Cardiff, was
yeah,
it?
That
it?
University of South Wales in Cardiff, yeah.
Right. And so, like, how long were you on that course, teaching on that course?
Well, I mean, I've had a really long association with the course that goes right back to me being a student there in the early 80s. And I left in 84, and I first worked as a technician on the course, and then I left that and, you know, took on the precarious life of a freelance photographer, but always kept going back and doing visiting, lecturing and things. So I've always had a connection with the course throughout all the 30 plus years, 40 years even. But this time, it's the first time I came back and taught full time. And I did that for nearly 14 years. And like wow. You said, I've just retired. In fact, this is my first week of retirement. So,
wow. I was curious about how that feels and whether that has kind of prompted some reflection and some kind of thoughts about what's next and, you know, what you're going to do with yourself, whether maybe you're going to pick up the camera for the first time in a while. What are your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, well, I mean, inevitably you do have to consider those things, don't you, when you're looking at, you know, how do you fill this time that you now have available to you? And I mean, photography is an option, of course, As you say, I haven't really picked up a camera in earnest for quite some time. I still love photography. I'm still involved in photography. And, you know, I can't imagine that ever changing. But whether I'll actually make photographs again myself, I'm not really very sure, if I'm really honest with you. I mean, I think the thing I've realized about teaching is that you kind of give all your best ideas away, you know, and that's fine. And I think that's how it should be. But it's kind of draining in that regard. But also, I don't feel the same sort of fire in my belly to make pictures in the way that I did, you know, in the period of time that I'm probably known for, you know, in the sort of 80s and 90s. Because I really felt then that I had something to say. There were things that concerned me that I wanted to use photography to address and articulate. And I guess the truth is that I'm now older, I'm more settled, you know, I'm certainly more privileged and more comfortable than I was then. And I don't feel the same kind of anxiety or urge to make pictures. That doesn't mean to say there's still shit going on that bothers me. I just don't really have the energy to take it on.
Yeah, I guess partly you're politically motivated by, you know, the Thatcher years, that time that you're kind of referencing, that you're well known for producing work by. So, you know, she's long gone. She was a great inspiration for a lot of people to become politically engaged. What was that your main motivation, do you think, for producing that work that you're known for?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, the way that the nation was rapidly changing, because of all those kind of Thatcherite policies, really. You know, the kind of free market economy, you know, cutting the market free and letting that decide how things work out. And then the fallout of all of that, which, of course, was particularly impactful in the north of England, you know, where I'm originally from. You know, I was kind of personally invested in it because I had friends and family who were suffering as a result of that, really. So it was something that I wanted to take on, most definitely. Yeah. And it's always, to be honest, Ben, it's the thing that really brought me into photography anyway, was seeing it as a kind of a tool, you know, to make work that was kind of questioning, that might shine a light on certain, you know, social injustices or certain political concerns and inequalities. That's the thing that really got me interested in photography in the first place. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the more I learned about photography, and the more work I saw from other photographers, my sense of what photography was and what it could do changed. And I became equally as interested in it as a kind of expressive medium, I suppose, really.
Well, I want to kind of get deeper into some of that and go back to discuss some of that stuff that you produced in that period. But just to sort of stick with where we were, I was thinking about this, you know, that this idea that, you know, one's creativity might have a sort of natural lifespan that is finite, and why would we assume necessarily that someone's going to carry on making work forever? And maybe, you know, maybe you're done, you know, maybe you've said what you wanted to say.
Yeah, right.
Do you think that way?
I totally do, and it's nice to hear you sort of see that and acknowledge that, because, you know, I think it's true that, you know, some people have a kind of a point where they make their best work and they've said what they want to say and that's it. And it used to really deeply trouble me because, you know, I studied on a course where, you know, the work ethic was just ridiculous. You know, you were expected to shoot, you know, 5 rolls of film a day and have 2 critiques on the work a day. And it was really good, don't get me wrong. It was a fantastic training. But one quickly learned to feel guilty about not working. And so it's taken me a long time to shake that off and to feel comfortable with, you know, not doing it.
No, I can imagine. And I think, you know, like you say, I mean, it's good when you're doing a course or something, because that the, just the sheer repetition of it and the kind of the intensity of it is gonna stand you in good stead. But then everyone ultimately works at their own pace. And we, you know, think about all the great, you know, novelists who've done one or two fantastically good books, and that's it. You know, it's like, there you go, nothing more from them. And I just don't see why it can't be the same way with photographers. But you've got other things going on. You've got quite a young daughter. She's probably a teenager right now. Yeah. So imagine that, you know, you could be kind of committed to spending time on the parenting thing. What else are you thinking about?
Well, I play music. I've played trumpet. I've played trumpet for a long time. So that, you know, fills some time. And a couple of years ago, I was quite ill. I had a heart attack, and so I had some time off work that was enforced. And during that time, I started to teach myself to paint. I do a lot of that now as well.
Oh wow! So that's a very recent kind of development for you. That you wasn't something that you had going on before.
Not really. I mean, you know, I come from a family where I've got, I was one of five boys, and I'm the youngest, and all of my brothers were very able at painting and drawing. And I always sort of thought I was rubbish, you know, so it was one of those things that I thought, I just can't do that, so I won't go there. Yeah, but when I was sick, I thought, well, I'll just give it a go, you know, and like everybody else, you know, taught myself through endless YouTube videos. And realized that actually, I mean, I'm not brilliant by any stretch, but, you know, I'm kind of quite pleased with some of the things that I've done. I mean, what's interesting, I think, is the things I choose to paint are photographs.
Oh, right. Okay. You know, yeah, so, that makes a certain amount of sense.
Yeah. And that's been really interesting for me, because, you know, painting, it forces you to really look intensely at things. And, you know, I've been painting photographs that I thought I knew really, really well. And it's only when, you know, you're looking the way that you have to, you know, the way that the light falls, the way the light reacts on surfaces, you know, the nature of surfaces themselves that you've got to kind of replicate in some way. I've started to discover things in pictures that I just, you know, missed, really.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing that you can continue to do that, even the, as you say, pictures that you think you're incredibly familiar with. But also, I like this idea that, you know, you've kind of adopted what they call a beginner's mindset in a way, which, you know, is what you need to do if you want to kind of experiment with creative. I mean, when you're younger, you know, like, why do we have these stories that we tell ourselves about what we're crap at and what we're any good at? You know, it's like, you can't really know that until you try. And then, funnily enough, you know, in your sort of maturity, you've kind of suddenly realized, or perhaps not suddenly, but you've realized that, well, it's nothing to lose by, you know, trying these things. No, you know, the art police aren't kind of going to swoop down and take your easel away if it doesn't, you know, work out.
Yeah, and there's no real expectations there in the way that there would be if I was making photographs, you know.
Right, exactly, yeah. So there's a freedom to it.
It's very liberating, yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering about you having retired, what your reflections are on all your years of running the documentary course, and what your feelings are about documentary photography, you know, in 2021, and whether it's sort of in a healthy state of affairs, you know, does it have a future? Do you reflect on those kind of questions?
Yes, I do. Professionally, I've had to, of course. I think it's an interesting time, most certainly, because, you know, the very nature of, you know, what I understand to be documentary photography seems to be challenged, you know, the kind of veracity of the image. And, you know, we see that, don't we, in the Jonas Benediktsson recent project, you know, where he's playing with that idea, you know, that sort of accepted belief in images. And it's interesting. And it's interesting from the work that he's making, because he's acknowledging it and he's playing with the idea. What troubles me, I suppose, is, you know, when that's not declared in quite the same way. And when people do, just by nature, tend to mistrust images, then it seems to me that it sucks a lot of the power away from a documentary practice. That concerns me.
Yeah, that's a really interesting issue. And I think, and hopefully, I don't know, I was reading about the Jonas Bendixson thing only last night, I think, was the first time I sort of read the full story. But I mean, the listeners hopefully will be aware of what's going on. But he got involved with some, deliberately and in a considered way, produced an entire project that was basically fake. And, you know, the whole point was to explore some of these issues. But like you say, if you, it's all sorts of cases of let's say, kind of ethically dubious stuff have come up over the recent years, now that, you know, pictures are so easy to manipulate digitally. And, you know, some fairly big names have been kind of implicated in some of that. So that, like you say, is a kind of ongoing issue in the world of documentary photography, because what can we trust now?
Yeah,
is the question.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, I suppose, you know, the market, if to give it a crude term, for documentary has also changed very significantly. You know, I spent a lot of time working for the color supplements on assignments, you know, and obviously they don't really exist anymore. And so, understandably, a lot of documentary practitioners have to find different ways of making work and finding an audience. In recent years, that's happened through the art world, hasn't it? You know.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say and ask you about this, because it seems to me like maybe that even documentary photography has become somewhat unfashionable, and that everyone now wants to be an artist, really, rather than what I suppose you might broadly have considered to be more of a journalistic approach. Like, is that something, a trend that you've seen among the students that you've had in recent years, or what's your general impression?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, what's the term that most people use now, an artist using photography, you know, it's certainly very commonplace. I mean, I've always maintained that I'm a photographer, and I've always tried to, you know, encourage my students to think of themselves first and foremost as photographers, and to make work that's felt and that's true and that's got kind of integrity, rather than trying to second guess, you know, the market, really.
Yeah. What's the work ethic like, generally speaking, among the younger generation? Do they have that work ethic that you were sort of encouraged to develop when you did the course all those years ago?
Yeah, I mean, some do and some don't. I mean, I think the reality is that there's a different kind of student now that would study on the course. Mm. You know, when I was a student, we all had those lofty ambitions, you know, of maybe eventually becoming a member of Magnum, you know, and working on international magazine assignments. You know, clearly that's not an option anymore. So, you know, students have got different ambitions and they expect different things from the course. I think the most overriding fact is that most of them are having to hold down full-time jobs, you know, in order to study. And that's crippling, really, because they just can't, you know, commit the amount of time that they ultimately need to do what they have to do in what is effectively a very limited time of 3 years study. So that's the most frustrating thing, I think.
Hmm. I mean, do you think there are aspects of the sort of, you know, photo landscapes that are advantageous now over, you know, what the kind of world that you came of age in terms of the opportunities that people have got, or, you know, the kind of digital world, you know, on the one hand being definitely a challenge to operate in, but then in kind of compensation, there are a few, you know, advantages, I suppose you might say.
Yeah, I think the barriers have come down. We're not in the silos, you know, that we used to be in. I can remember having to be quiet about the kind of commercial things that I did, because it tainted my, you know, my kind of personal practice, you know. I don't think that's the case anymore. It's now you can move effortlessly, can't you, between, you know, the gallery wall or, you know, the magazine pages or, you know, the fashion journals. or or the advertising clients. So I think that's really healthy that there's many more opportunities now for young photographers.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I was interested to hear you talking about your sort of lack of confidence, you know, something that you, I don't know whether it's sort of in some respects stayed with you, but when you come across a student on the course that sort of, you know, reminds you of you in that respect, and you might identify that sort of lack of confidence, is there anything you can do to sort of help them get over that in a way? Is that an experience that you've had to, you know, have?
I mean, the lack of confidence has plagued me all of my life. So it's something that's, in some ways, it's been a blessing and a curse, you know. It's been a blessing, I suppose, because I was always really quite shy as a kid, and would always find ways of just, you know, entering my own world. And so the idea of being a photographer, you know, being on the outside looking in, was perfect for somebody of my disposition. So that was great. But of course, the thing that held me back is that to be successful in this business, you also need to be quite gregarious and quite an extrovert, and, you know, you have to be good at self-promotion, etc. And that doesn't come easy to the likes of people like myself. And when I see that in students, I just try and make them believe in themselves, you know, try and be as supportive and as encouraging as you can be, and get them to recognize that, you know, there's some real qualities in what they're doing. I mean, you know, I when I was at school, I still suffer from quite bad dyslexia. But, you know, I'm of a generation where it wasn't really acknowledged as a condition. And so I was labelled, you know, as being academically kind of incapable. I mean, Ben, you wouldn't believe the things that used to happen to me, because I've also got numeracy issues as well. So I struggle with maths still to this day. But when I was at primary school, I was in a maths lesson where they used to make you all stand up at the beginning of the class, and the teacher would go around and ask you a times table. And when you got it right, you sat down. And I was always the last man standing in the class, me and a guy called Roy Smith. And the way that they used to deal with it was they took us out of the maths lesson and they had us drilling holes in pieces of wood for scissors for the art department. And so by the time I went to high school, my maths level was way behind everybody else. And that just self-perpetuates, you know. So I've kind of got used to that idea of thinking myself that I'm not good at things, you know. It's a terrible position to be in, isn't it? I mean, you know, thankfully there's a lot more support now for people.
Well, like you say, those things are so much better understood. And, you know, I remember even, you know, I mean, I'm a little younger than you, but even in my generation, you know, my brother was dyslexic at school, and, you know, there was no diagnosis of that condition at that time. You just thought you were kind of, you know, like you say, slow, and you were kept back a year. And it was just basically the die was kind of cast, which is a kind of terrible thing, because we know that dyslexia doesn't have to be, you know, any kind of an impediment really now, you know, and it's like, it's better understood and how to deal with all
that. I actually think it's an advantage, you know, if you're a visual artist, photographer,
definitely,
whatever we're going to call, you know, the people that do the things that we do, it's definitely an advantage. And I'm always, when I interview students, I'm always encouraged when I hear that somebody's dyslexic, because I think what dyslexic people do is they find coping mechanisms, they find ways around things. So actually they become really inventive. And they tend to be, in my experience, more visual.
That's probably true. And the shyness is an interesting thing, because I'm beginning to understand that shyness is a kind of actually a very common trait among photographers. I was talking to Tom Wood the other week, and I was sort of quite interested to hear that he, like you, it was a shy person. And, you know, these things are not evident from the photographs that he takes, or that indeed that you take. But I think that kind of general sort of social awkwardness is more common than not among photographers, and that maybe photography is a way to get over that, in a sense, a kind of mechanism to sidestep it. Did you find that the case with you yourself?
I don't think it's a way of getting over things. I think it's a way of participating without being there.
In
a way, you know, you're witness to things, but you're not really a player, you know.
You don't have to say anything if you've got a camera in front of you.
You don't have to say anything, yeah. And, you know, you can walk away if it feels awkward.
yeah, exactly.
It's just a way of being in a moment, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's definitely the case for me. I mean, we've got to sort of talk about the kind of defining aspect of your work and your life, which is that the influence of your sort of working class roots on, you know, the person that you became and the sort of work that you did. And I guess that the kind of lack of confidence, you know, in a way, plays into that as well. I mean, you left school at 15 or something. You worked as a builder for the early part of your life. I think you sort of talked about having a sense of imposter syndrome in a way that, you know, you perhaps have never felt quite comfortable despite, you know, an incredible career as a photographer. Does that ever go away, that sense of imposter syndrome?
Regrettably, no. It never does go away. And I still have it in music as well, you know. Mm. I mean, for a shy person, you know, why the hell did I choose to play the trumpet, you know, as an instrument?
Right, yeah.
You know, I should have been a bass player or something. But So I still feel, you know, that the people I play music with, I'm the worst player in the room, you know, so it never really, really goes away. But I guess I've just learned to embrace it. And I think that what comes out of it are qualities that manifest themselves either in the music or in the photography that otherwise wouldn't be there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it does. Your formative years, tell me a little bit about it. I know that, you know, you actually ended up doing a project about your father. Let me remind myself what it was called, Portrait of an Invisible Man,
well done.
It was called. Yeah, and he was there turned out to be a fascinating story that I guess you didn't know. But you described the fact that he was essentially fairly absent. Why was that? What did he do for a living and that kind of stuff?
Okay, well, he was a door-to-door salesman. Although I'm one of five, my four brothers are half brothers. So my mum's husband, my brother's father, died shortly after the end of the Second World War. Mm. And so my dad became their stepdad.
Right.
And I think I was probably an accident, really, you know, and that he felt obliged to kind of stay around but really not be there because he had the perfect excuse that, you know, he was traveling salesman, so he was away an awful lot. Mm. So my mum brought us up single-handedly, really.
Yeah.
But my dad, you know, I mean, I don't want to speak ill of him because he's no longer with us. But, you know, it's important in order to answer your question that you kind of understand the kind of man that he was or the kind of man that I thought that he was, really, because he was quite an intimidating figure. He was nicknamed Lofty in the war. He was a paratrooper, and he was 6'5", you know, very tall, very imposing character. And he terrified me, you know. I could never please him. You know, he'd always get me to wash the car, and it was never good enough, you know, so I had to go back out and do it three or four times. And I just never really had a relationship with him, the likes of which I desired, I suppose. Never took it on, never faced it, just thought, well, you know, that's how it is. It's this kind of absence in my life. And until I became a father myself for the first time. So when my son was born, I really understood that connection, you know, between father and child, and couldn't quite comprehend why he didn't feel the same way about me. And then I was older, I was more confident. I was, you know, I had a camera, I knew how to use it, and I decided that I would try and ask him and tackle, you know, what's going on? Why are you the way you are? You know, where have you been all my life? And the only way I could think of doing it was by hiding behind a camera, you know. So I started a photographic project about him, which, like you say, became titled Portrait of an Invisible Man. But what I discovered was that there was good reasons for him being the way that he was, because he was captured during the Second World War, and he was initially a POW. But when the Nazis found out that he was a paratrooper, they didn't give him the protection of the Geneva Convention, and so he was put in a concentration camp, and he was eventually shipped to an extermination camp. He had a half a number tattooed on his arm, so he was in line for being executed. And eventually, he was pulled out of line because he was so big and so strong that they thought they'd make use of him. And so he worked off camp in one of the paper mills, and he eventually escaped with a Canadian, an Australian soldier, and three Ukrainian women. And they walked. So he was in Poland, is where the camp was. He walked, all of them walked to Odessa, and he was liberated on a British hospital ship back to the UK. And when I heard that story, because it never spoke about any of this stuff, and so the first time we talked about it is when I started this project. And you know, the process was, we'd have a conversation, I'd photograph him, he'd tell me things, I'd go off to the Imperial War Museum and go through the archives and try and find some kind of, you know, documentary evidence of all of this stuff. And so very, very slowly, I unpicked this story from this man, who was clearly very troubled by the experience that he'd had and very damaged by it, really. And so he was very detached, very unemotional. He was had this kind of obsession with keeping things. So he would never open Christmas presents. So he had drawers full of unopened presents, cupboards full of empty plastic bags. You know, he was a hoarder. And when I realized that actually, you know, goodness knows what he witnessed in that camp, and goodness knows what experiences he encountered along that long journey, and how his life depended on perhaps small things like, you know, the possession of a morsel of food. You know, I could understand how somebody could become emotionally detached and self-serving and obsessive. And the brilliant thing was that that project healed our relationship. I get quite emotional when I talk about it, because it was, I think it's the only time that I can say with any certainty that photography did something.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, yeah, exactly that, because if it wasn't for photography, you wouldn't have ever really had the excuse that you used it for to you know, start asking those questions and sort of, yeah, finding all that stuff out. And that, there you go. So in a way, that's the power of it. Amazing story. And yeah, I guess, you know, an experience that was probably quite common to his generation, or to your generation of people whose dads were, you know, had that wartime or some kind of wartime trauma.
Yeah.
So what was your sort of trajectory from kind of being a bricklayer to then ending up studying photography at Newport? What sort of sparked your interest? How did that happen?
Okay. Well, music's always been really important to me, and I came to photography via music, really. So I was, you know, when I was a teenager, I was massively into the Northern Soul scene. So, you know, I'd go to all-nighters, Twisted Wheel in Manchester, and the Torch in Tunstall, and Wigan Casino, which is probably the better-known place. Mm. And again, because I was shy and unconfident, I was never one of these flamboyant dancers. So I would always just sit and listen to the music. And what I realized, and the music's very particular for your listeners that may not know what Northern Soul is.
Mm.
So it's basically rare soul records coming out of small independent record labels, primarily from the southern states of America, all of whom were trying to emulate the sound and success of Motown. So it's very danceable music. It's very, it's got this kind of, you know, backbeat that's very infectious. But unlike Motown, the lyrical content of a lot of Northern Soul was about the experiences that these Southern state musicians were having outside the studio. So it's about their lives, and it's about the inequalities that they're experiencing.
Mm.
And only when I sat and really started to listen to the lyrical content did I start to understand this. And I thought, okay, you know, not to belittle anything of the African-American experience, because it's very real, but, you know, if you take race out of the equation and replace it with the word class, there's a lot of similarity, there's a lot of common ground there that was that I could identify with.
Mm.
And I think that's partly a reason why that particular music was so successful in the north of England, because all the people that are at these things are working in factories, and, you know, they're plumbers, they're seamstresses, and, you know, they're just living for the weekend, really. They're doing these, you know, sort of arduous jobs, and it's their release at the weekend. And so something in that music, and certainly the lyrics, made me think about my life. And so as a result of that, I suppose I became politicized through the music. I'd start to read, a lot of literature around the civil rights movement. I'd spend a lot of time in my local library looking through books. And I happened to come across a book on the bookshelf called Fenton Shots, which was a collection of photographs from the civil rights movement and from some of the early Vietnam War protests. And for the first time, I think I recognized the power of photography to communicate ideas. And so I started to become more and more interested in photography. I had a very dear friend, a guy called Andy Simpson, who sadly passed away last year, who had a camera. And he lent me the camera, and I started making pictures around town in Bradford, up in Yorkshire. And you know what it's like. I'm sure you've been there, you know, those kind of nursery slopes of photography. You know, the obsession grows. I had a little dark room in the cloak room of the house, you know, and I'd make these tiny little bromide prints on my hands and knees underneath the coats and stuff. And it just became more and more of an obsession. And then I was working as a brickie, like you say, and I went to work in Germany, you know, did the Auf Wiedersehen Pet thing. I was over there for 4 years, but still kept photographing. And the obsession grew and grew to the point where I thought, I think I'm going to try and do something with this. And I remember at the time the British Journal of Photography used to do a directory of where to study photography. And so I'd asked my mum to get a copy and send it over to me. And so I went through this thing and I looked at all the courses that I thought I'd be interested in. And by then I kind of knew something a little bit about documentary photography. So when I came across this course that was just documentary photography, and I think I'm right in saying at that time it was probably the only course in Britain that specialised in documentary, I was absolutely certain that that's where I wanted to study. So I applied. I was given an interview, and I came back from Germany for the interview. I was so adamant that I wasn't going to go back to the life of being a brickie in Germany. I don't know if you've ever been in Germany in the middle of winter, but, you know, standing on a scaffolding in Stuttgart is not the nicest place to be in sort of December, January.
No.
So I was determined that whatever the outcome of this interview was, I wasn't going to go back to being a brickie. And I chucked all my tools into the North Sea off the ferry.
Right.
So it was, you know, kind of...
All or nothing.
All or nothing, absolutely. I was going to use a less polite expression, but yes, all or nothing. And thankfully, I got a place on the course, and it's quite literally changed my life, really.
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
And it was at that point, Ben, when I realized that I wasn't stupid, you know.
Right.
Because it's true then, most certainly. It's true today, but on the course, you know, a wide range of people, all different kinds of backgrounds, all different ages. You know, I studied with people who were doing the course they had already got a degree or two, you know, and some of them are like Cambridge, Oxbridge graduates. And I'm on the course with them, and I could hold my own, and I sort of recognized, you know, that actually I can do this, you know. Mm.
Yeah.
And it's, I suppose, really when I started to have that sense of self-belief. So it was a sort of transformative experience for me.
And from the start, your interest really was in portraying, you know, the world that you were familiar with, the kind of working class British life in a way. Was the Valleys Project your sort of entree into that? Because that was pretty early on, I seem to remember.
Yeah, it was shortly after I had finished the course. So, it would have been 85, 86, I think. I finished in 84. Mm. I think I, from the very beginning, I just photographed things that I knew. Because that seemed to me to be the sensible thing. But also, and it goes back to this idea of confidence as well, I photographed in environments where I felt comfortable.
Yeah, of course.
And I photographed in environments that I understood. So I spent a lot of time, you know, having worked on building sites, obviously, you know, working around guys all the time, I felt more comfortable in those kind of male-dominated environments. And so I'd spent a lot of time in steel mills, coal mines and places like that because it sort of felt familiar to me.
At what point did you discover August Sander? Because it feels like maybe that he was quite an influence in that early stage.
Yeah, I mean, we used to have a brilliant series of history of photography lectures that were given to us by a woman called Eileen Gibson Cowan and then Ian Walker. And I think it was possibly Ian Walker that first showed us the work of August Sander. And the picture that he showed us first was of a bricklayer in Germany. And, you know, I'd been working with guys that looked exactly like this person looked. So, okay, you know, it wasn't in the 1920s, but nothing much had changed. They still use the same tools. They still dress the same way. And so, again, it's that idea of familiarity, I suppose. I felt an affinity and a connection with that work.
Yeah, and the Valleys thing, well, let's explain what that was about, because it seemed to like it was essentially a kind of documentation of the way in which the industry in Wales was undergoing a kind of radical change at that stage. And who was it that kind of set the thing up?
It was a photo gallery in Cardiff. So it was, I think it was a series of three commissions initially. The whole series of commissions ran for, I think, 4 or 5 years. And I was in the first round of commissions. So there was myself, Ron McCormick, and John Davis were the three photographers who were commissioned. And it was open submission, so you had to, you know, put in an idea, a proposal, and it was my proposal to look at the impact, both sociologically and environmentally, of the introduction of the light technological manufacturing industries that were being attracted to South Wales, because it was, at the time, really interesting. You know, you're talking about an area that has been dominated by heavy industry. Largely, you know, male workforce, and that all going into very steep decline, and the being replaced by these light technological sort of computer component manufacturing industries that were employing mainly women. So you had this whole kind of reversal of roles that were going on in society. The landscape was being, you know, reshaped. A lot of the old sites of some of the pits were being leveled, and these sort of tin sheds were being put on those sites. So it was, I thought, a really interesting period of time in Welsh history.
Yeah, this was the sort of height of Thatcherism, of course, mid-80s.
Yeah.
And you sort of, that became your sort of dominant area of interest in a way for quite a long time. You sort of segued into a thing about consumerism, essentially, which was I Can Help, and became a book. And you sort of switched to colour very deliberately for that. I guess that seemed like the appropriate approach for that particular subject matter. Because of what? The garishness of consumer, of that kind of a landscape in a way, the colours and...
Yeah, it was, I suppose it was about, you know, the language of colour and the way that it was deployed in these supermarkets or, you know, points of sale various. Because it wasn't just supermarkets that I was making work in. But I think I recognised really early on that colour was being used in a very deliberate way. You know, so you'd have, like, if you went into somewhere like MFI, you know, you'd have a very deliberate use of bright primary colors at the point of sale. But then when you went over to, you know, the collection point where you had to sit and wait for your order to be assembled, you know, they were using very cool sort of pastel colors, you know, because it made you feel relaxed and you weren't conscious of all the time you were sat waiting. So I thought, you know, the psychological use of colour was really interesting. And so I thought it would be a nonsense really to ignore that. The other thing as well was I was really aware of what was happening with colour in documentary in Britain. Mm. You know, Paul Graham had done the A1. Martin Parr was just starting on The Last Resort. And so, you know, that was becoming more and more interesting.
Yeah, and you were sort of instrumental in, you were very much part of that sort of the landscape of that change. And I've got a picture which is part of this project that I've been working on for a long time. And I was displaying some of these at one point, and someone said, "I like the Paul Rees picture." And I was like, "Ah, wait, which one?" And then, of course, I think I knew your B&Q picture. Hang on, I'm going to show it to you. The listeners can't see this, but that's my homage to you. That's my Paul Rees picture. But you can see what they were getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, it's, there you go. You have kind of defined a subgenre in a way, which must feel, you know, must feel all right, despite your ongoing lack of confidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's important, though, to remember who was at the forefront of all of that. And that was...
Absolutely.
You know, that was most definitely Martin, Paul Graham, and, you know, other people as well who never really get acknowledged. You know, people like Charlie Meacham, Bob Phillips, you know, all beavering away, you know, making colour photographs. Gem, of course, Gem Southam. So yeah, they were kind of ahead of the game, really.
Sure, but it's not just the color; it's the subject matter as well. So it's the combination of those two things that kind of defines, you know, the kind of style of thing that you were doing anyway. Mm. And again, I suppose yeah, they were doing those things as well. Martin certainly, you know,
yeah.
I'm sure spent a fair amount of time lurking around in supermarkets.
For sure.
Speaking of Martin, there has often been a kind of general criticism leveled, you know, at him specifically, but I'm wondering if whether, you know, a whole bunch of people were kind of implicated that, you know, in a way that in portraying kind of a certain aspect of working class life, you were, that photographers were kind of somehow poking fun at the subjects that they were photographing. Is that something that you were aware of or have ever felt that you were partly, you know, being accused of?
Not quite as voraciously as perhaps Martin has been accused of. But yes, I mean, certainly some people have taken issue with the kind of pictures that I made. I mean, I always maintained that, you know, although I was photographing people, I never really think about my photographs as being totally about people. They're about the systems that we're all subjected to, you know, whether it's consumerism or unemployment or whatever it might be. So they're about those kind, they try and be about those bigger themes, really. I think there's two reasons why that criticism was leveled at people like Martin and myself. And some of it is to do with the representation of people through the photographs. But I think it was also this interesting shift that happened in documentary at this particular point in time, in British documentary, where, you know, it wasn't just about the use of colour that was the thing that distinguished, you know, what used to be called this new generation of documentary photographers. It was also a change in attitude towards subject matter. Because, you know, I think up to that point, a lot of British documentary was interested in kind of quirky, obscure, extreme things. And I think, you know, the guys, the people that were starting to work in color were more interested in the ordinary and the everyday. And I think it took people a while to get their heads around that. And I think some people felt uncomfortable about that and maybe even threatened by those changes in some way. So I think there's lots of weird things happening. People were lashing out for lots of strange reasons. All of which, you know, in retrospect, seems rather pointless and silly now.
Yeah. It's always seemed to me kind of slightly strange that people feel like the working class, as if they're this fragile little group that need to be defended against, you know, baddies, you know, from the middle. It's like, what every other class that we have has been kind of relentlessly portrayed in all kinds of pretty undesirable ways. You know, the middle classes have the piss ripped out of them constantly for good reason. And indeed, so do the sort of, you know, the upper classes in this country. And I'm like, well, why are the working class not fair game as well? I don't really understand that.
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, you're right. But I think it's about power, isn't it? And it's about access to power as well.
I think that is the answer. Yes, that you've kind of nailed it there in a way. That is what it's about.
It's also about how that kind of imagery becomes defining of a particular class, and how that can limit, you know, the expectations and the possibilities of people who are defined only as that. And I think that's really quite problematic, and that's, in some ways, part of the reason why I don't photograph like that anymore as well. I think I've found it personally, and I, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, everybody shouldn't be doing that, but personally, I found it harder and harder to justify that kind of representation for those reasons, really.
Yeah, yeah. And despite the fact that you come from a working class background yourself, and you feel a great affinity towards the people that you're photographing because, you know, you can relate to them on that level.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was photographing in B&Q and Tesco, you know, I wasn't photographing in Waitrose and Marks and Spencers. You know, why wasn't I doing that? Because I felt comfortable and I felt familiar in those places.
The other thing that you sort of explored in Flogging a Dead Horse, and I think that this preceded the I Can Help work, actually. I might have gone out of chronological order, but that was really about the way in which sort of, I don't know, heritage was kind of being packaged up and kind of sold as a kind of consumer product in a way, or kind of a means of entertainment. Could you, well, maybe I shouldn't really be speaking for you. Maybe you could say yourself what, you know, the way which you viewed that that subject.
Okay. I mean, it actually came after I Can Help. It was.
Oh, it did. Okay. So I was going the right.
It was published in the early 90s, 93, I think, by Corner House, Dowie Lewis. And Yeah, it was like you've said, it was looking at heritage culture, and it was looking at the way that at that particular point in time, working class experience was being kind of packaged and sanitized and reappropriated as a kind of form of entertainment in these kind of heritage parks, places like Beamish in the north of England, that calls itself the Northern Experience. And interestingly, all the represent, because it's people that dress up in costumes and assume characters. So I'm sorry about the dog.
That's okay. So don't worry.
It's a kind of living experience, you know, a living museum. But a lot of the imagery that informed those characters was coming from early documentary photography. So, you know, that idea of how one is classified and categorized through photography. You know, there's the evidence, really. So anyway, it was looking at how, I suppose, how work had become a kind of, has been, become a form of entertainment. So, you know, you could go on a guided tour down a coal mine, or, you know, go and watch somebody, you know, washing their smalls in a tin bath in the back alley, you know.
Right, yeah. I guess, you know, there was the real version was not so far away, but, you know, this is the kind of sanitized version, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. You never saw any of the hardships, you know.
No, yeah.
And then I kind of broadened it and looked at heritage culture more widely, really. So it wasn't just about working class industrial culture. I looked at kind of, you know, the way that, in Britain, places used to be known for what they made. You know, Sheffield was steel, Wales was coal, you know, Manchester was textiles. And once all of that industry went into decline, a lot of places were struggling to redefine themselves. And so, you know, you'd find places springing up like Catherine Cookson country, you know. So, and there'd be, you know, the Brown Heritage Site on the motorway that would welcome you to Shakespeare country or wherever it was. So I was interested in this new kind of cultural map that was being drawn of Britain through heritage culture. And so I spent a lot of time photographing in different heritage sites. Yeah.
I'm wondering about whether the kind of issues that we have facing, what we're facing currently, you know, are very different in a way to the ones that you photographed. And perhaps one of the reasons that you haven't taken any pictures for a long time is that you're just not sure, you wouldn't be sure how to photograph those things, that maybe they're things which are more abstract and harder to make pictures of. Is that something, do you think that's part of the problem?
For me, certainly, yeah. But obviously, you know, there are lots of people who've made really great work of things that are, you know, invisible and not as immediately accessible. So, you know, it is possible to do. I guess, you know, for me, that would be one of the reasons why I'm not doing it, because I find it harder to access those things.
Yeah, yeah. I always end up talking about this, the impending kind of environmental catastrophe that we're facing, you know, which is like, without doubt, the kind of most significant existential threat we've ever really faced. And there are a lot of people, I think, doing good work about on that subject, to the point where perhaps, you know, one might think, oh, I don't know what I can add to it that's different or new. Do you think it's important to, you know, have your own take on things, or that, you know, that if you're not doing something that's different to everyone else, there's kind of no point in doing it?
Well, I mean, why do things have to be different? Who says, you know, that they have to be different? I mean,
that's what I'm thinking.
We know the answer to that, of course. It's because, you know, that's how you kind of progress and shape a career, you know, is by being that person that has that different take on something or photograph something that's never been photographed before. But, you know, in terms of the great expanse of history, you know, does it really matter, you know, who did it and who was the first to do it? As long as all that stuff is there and it's documented and it's recorded in a kind of, you know, an ethical way, that for me is ultimately the important thing, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm really glad to have had this chat with you, Paul, and I really appreciate you doing it. I hope you will stick around to do these bonus questions, which are for the members only, but it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Ben. Thanks for asking me.